Thanks for coming along tonight to what I'm going to call the Sydney launch of this official history of Australia and East Timor. And Craig Stockings makes a welcome return to the Institute. He was here some years ago, and it's great to have him back. Now, he's here on the occasion of the publication of this great book, which I will struggle to lift. Born of Fire and Ash, Australian Operations in Response to the East Timor Crisis, 1999 to 2000, which is volume one of the official history of the Australian peacekeeping operations in East Timor, published by the Australian War Memorial and UNSW Press. And we've got copies of that for sale either online or here tonight. Now, I should introduce our speaker. He's well known, but I'll introduce him very briefly. He's the official historian of the Australian operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and East Timor. Craig is, Professor Stockings is, a graduate of both the Australian Defence Force Academy and the Royal Military College, Duntroon, and concurrent with his appointment as official historian, he is Professor of History at the University of New South Wales, Canberra. And tonight our speaker is going to talk on East Timor, Born of Fire and Ash. Craig, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Guests, colleagues and friends, all at once tonight I find myself excited. I'm honoured to be here and I'm also relieved. And I'm relieved because there's been many occasions in the last 5 years I thought perhaps we would never have the opportunity to gather together for an event such as this one. That is, at a certain point and in my more solemn moments along what's been an interesting road, I was never certain the book we see to my left here would exist or would exist in a form that's readable or releasable to the public. That it is, in my mind at least, is a cause for celebration. So I relish then the opportunity to talk to you all about Born of Fire and Ash, the first, as Jared mentioned, the first volume of the official history of Australian operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and Australian peacekeeping operations in East Timor, the first of 6 volumes in this particular official history series. My thanks, of course, for the invitation, Jared and the Sydney Institute. My thanks to you all for turning up and for me having the chance to talk to you about this book and the sometimes rocky path that we took to produce it. But I think the best point to start here is to quickly describe what official history really means, why this book is different from those who come before it on similar topics, and why it will be different from those that follow. For the writing of official history in Australia, one and all, has a more than a century-old tradition behind it. It's an institution tied intimately to the Australian War Memorial, which was mentioned, which has sponsored such work from the time the memorial was conceived. Yet the projects themselves have always been commissioned directly by the government of the day. As such, then, they are histories of and for all Australians. They're detailed, they're chronological records of all services and theatres and constitute, at least in my mind, a really important resource for readers at all levels, be they scholars, veterans, or the general public. They are, again, in my opinion at least, forgive me, enduring assets. They're comprehensive, they're authoritative, that's the purpose. They are independent. And this last point is worth dwelling upon, for unlike similar projects across the Anglosphere, the Australian official history tradition is unique that these works are produced outside of the system. That is, no public service department, no agency controls the research or productions of these official history volumes. No one may direct the contents of these histories or unduly influence the official historian, in theory anyways, but I'll return to that idea a little bit later on. In this sense, official histories then are official only in as much as they're commissioned by the government as a national record of Australians' involvement in any particular conflict. Official historians, myself included, are granted access to the closed period and classified records of all relevant departments and intelligence agencies, yet the volumes remain the author's own interpretations and the judgments do not follow any particular government line. They are, in this sense, a record of government actions and decisions based on government sources, but they're not government stories, all means by which certain narratives can be perpetuated at the expense of others. The history is then a product of historical investigations by independent researchers. The government pays the bill. It doesn't decide what's between those covers. They're also the foundation, I think, these histories and frameworks for future historians. There will be whole crops of PhD students that make a living off telling us how we're wrong, and that's absolutely appropriate. They're an accessible, as I mentioned, source for the veteran community and the public to gain insight into the sorts of theatres under examination. And I think this is particularly important today, given what might be called a disconnection between Australia's wars of the 21st century and the Australian public. I think it's important too, given what might describe a certain mismatches between the public narrative events in East Timor and Iraq and Afghanistan and the historical evidence at hand. Our outlook has been straightforward. We have not self-censored. We've included the bad with the good because frictions and mistakes are as part of the historical record as are unbridled successes. Achievements in spite of institutional shortcomings enhance the legacy of those involved, not the reverse. So we've written it as we see it, and as the evidence trail has indicated, these volumes are intended to be truthful, not necessarily triumphal. Thus far, various Australian governments since 1901 have commissioned six separate series of official war histories, one for each of the major conflicts or areas of conflict in which Australian troops have been involved. You'll all know the inaugural official history of Australia at war in the War of 1914-18, edited by the famous Charles Bean as the first official historian. Following Bean, the official history of Australia's involvement in the Second World War represents one of the largest and the longest historical projects the country's ever seen, running from 1943 all the way up to 1977, and 22 separate volumes, if memory serves. The third official history series was produced under the guiding hand of Professor Robert O'Neill, who was appointed as official history of a two-volume Korean War series published in 1981 and 1985. Next, Professor Peter Edwards was appointed as a country's fourth official historian in 1982 to produce a series on Australian involvements in Southeast Asian conflicts from 1948 to 1975, including, of course, the Vietnam War. More recently, in 2004, Professor David Horner was commissioned to write a fifth official history series, this one relating to peacekeeping and post-Cold War operations. I then am the sixth person to wear this mantle, responsible, as I've noted, for East Timor and Iraq and Afghanistan from the period 1999 up to 2014. In my eyes, the national significance of this type of undertaking speaks for itself. Australia's involvement in the Middle East alone in the 21st century has been complex and it's been long-running. Well over 40,000, and people don't usually recognise that number, more than 40,000 Australian Defence Force and public service personnel have served or supported the deployments to the Middle East in the last 13 years of operations. Sadly, 44 died on active services in the theatres and hundreds more have been wounded, sometimes physically, sometimes psychologically. The social and military effects of these conflicts globally and within the nation has been profound. By the same token, Australia's involvement in East Timor in the period 1999 to 2000, the subject of this particular book, was the largest mission Australia ever conducted under UN auspices, the largest overseas deployment since Vietnam or World War II, depending on how you measure it, and was an instrumental part of Timor-Leste gaining its independence. Subsequent ADF deployments to East Timor gave vital support to the fledgling nation. Taken in total then, these operations constitute, in my view, an important part of Australia's recent past, one that needs to be chronicled not only in an authoritative, but in an analytical way. Well, there's no question that each of the five official histories series that preceded my own has faced its own specific challenges and enjoyed its own individual advantages. One key difference, though, between this series and those that have gone before is the type and level of governance imposed upon it and within the project. But in stark reversal to David Horner's peacekeeping series, I've been well funded for the task. And the team has enjoyed a level of resourcing not available to any past official history series. So I guess one can't have their cake and eat it too. The obverse of deep government and war memorial funding are extremely tight timelines and rigid frameworks. My author teams initially had 5 years to complete their volumes, extended to 6.5 years in 2018, and I'll get back to that extension. A great deal less time has been available to any official history project since 1914. I've had author teams, ladies and gentlemen, on 6-week rolling chapter deadlines for approaching 2.5 years, which is an extraordinary rate of work. Certainly within an academic context, an extraordinary rate of work. Importantly, as with my more recent predecessors, my commission has provided for controlled access to live government files and records under special access arrangements set out in the Archives Act of 1983, subject only to national security requirements and restrictions. Though these volumes are themselves, when published, unclassified, and are written with this outcome in mind, they are based on a thorough study of the classified documentary record made available by the government for the operations covered. Material then excluded from myself or the official history team in whole or part is only that judged by the departments and agencies to be potentially damaging to Australian national security or national interests. Those agencies which have chosen to restrict their cooperation and access have done so on these grounds, but it has not been widespread, and I do not believe such omissions in any way have altered the conclusions that we might have reached or the stories we might have written in any fundamental manner. Ladies and gentlemen, in terms of this volume itself, I'm not too proud to stand in front of you this evening and tell you it was a difficult undertaking. Difficult, in truth, on three levels. In practical terms, in psychological terms, and on an emotional level too. And that's a bit strange, I'm not a very emotional person, but I'll be open here. First was the practical challenge of even accessing records, particularly electronic records, from government agencies and departments. For it was quickly apparent to me that the bureaucracy looked on events in East Timor and Iraq and Afghanistan with a whole new level of concern and sensitivity than it had with regards to the perceived benign nature of the peacekeeping official history that preceded us. The relatively free hand given for the peacekeepers, for example, to sift through various departments' electronic repositories was never going to be replicated for me. Not that I knew it at the time. Far more appeared to be at stake for various parties. Thus, with procedural and structural barriers in place from the start, the flow of records became unacceptably slow, particularly from Defence as our largest customer, as it were. And these events came to a head in 2017. The net result was an 18-month extension and the raising of a whole new directorate within that department whose sole job it was to catch and forward material to the project at an acceptable rate. And in the end, adequate flow rates of data were attained, but if I reflect on that time, the personal and the mental toll was pretty heavy. At all points, there were few individuals who were aware of the intricacies, the structures, the forces, the personalities against and within which the project struggled. And 2017 seems like a long, long time ago. As records began to flow at a rapid rate, another difficulty emerged, this one perhaps tied to the very success of overcoming the first problem. This challenge might be described as running the risk of drowning in a sea of infinite data in the age of electronic data. All records created by government departments and agencies in any way related to events under these three theatres exist in multiple electronic formats. Just think about that. All emails, all texts, all PowerPoint presentations, which often substitute for written orders nowadays, all Word documents, all spreadsheets, any other form of data presentation conceivable, and all the draft of those documents, sometimes complete with track changes, have been retained and are considered official records. While certainly not all that this type of data is easily accessed, and certainly it's very rarely curated in a form that makes it easy to use, the point is the amount of material open for historical purposes is enormous. What then is a researcher to do? There's no time and resources to examine even a fraction of this record. A more typical trawl approach that I'm used to, where a scholar might try to collect a large proportion of the invaluable records for interrogation, is no longer possible in 21st century historical research. rather approaches have had to shift towards much more targeted ways of doing things. Robust sets of filters have needed to be built to a far greater extent than any other project I've been part of over a lot of years. Specific sets of research questions have needed to be framed in advance of doing that primary work. That is, we seek targeted answers for specific questions and accept that gaps will emerge along the way, and we'll fill those in a similar manner when required. This represents and represented a significant challenge to the work habits of a historian working in the 21st century. No less a challenge, the psychological ramifications of this idea of infinite data. For myself, again, for most of the team, previous projects have always involved working through a finite number of archival records. And I feel I've done a good job. I feel duly conscientious when I can put my hand on my heart and tell myself I viewed a whole or part or a goodly part of the relevant record. I write history then always from what I've seen. Now, in truth, this sense of security has always been built on a falsehood. Intellectually, I'm aware that the record that has been entered into various archives only ever has represented a fraction of a percent of what might have been produced and written at the time. Think of all those notebook pages on the Kokoda Trail that ended up burned or left behind. We've only ever worked from a fraction. But the point is, even though I've only written history previously from the smallest sliver of data that's available, I've found solace in the fact that what lays outside of these sources no longer exists or is no longer accessible. Now the game's changed. The East Timor crisis in 1999 occurred at a point of transition as bureaucracies did start to move from paper to electronic records. And I benefit somewhat from a slightly curated record, but do you get a true sense of the digital sprawl that is now the norm? Digital files made available filled with diamonds surrounded by clutter, some in file formats that have long since become obsolete. The question then is when and where to stop. So where's my solace now in the professional sense? All I can say is that mindsets have and have had to alter. With deadlines, with fiscal constraint, we need to stop when reasonable answers have been garnered to the research questions at hand. We need to be comfortable, therefore, with what has not been done. It's not an easy or comfortable transition, but it is how all future historical work in the digital age will be framed. Now, another difficulty to move away from process, I admit, was the subject matter at hand for this particular book. The background reading is disturbing, to say the least. Many of you may know that from the time of the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in 1975, either directly or as a consequence of the policies of that occupation, as many as 200,000 East Timorese lost their lives. According to some estimates, this is a higher proportion of death within such a small population than any other 20th century experience. It's a traumatic story. So too traumatic was the events of early September 1999 when a surge of violence broke out in East Timor, which chased away more than a quarter of the 800,000 inhabitants from their homes and killed many, often in gruesome fashion. This was the price these Timorese paid for their own self-determination. This is why there was an Australian response. A special note here to the bravery, and that's the right word, for journalists who kept the flow of information and these disturbing and horrific images flowing out of the province into our living rooms in 1999 at great personal risk. Scenes of destruction shocked people across Australia from the cabinet to the average person on the street and helped make a response inevitable. Researching the atrocities perpetuated by anti-independence militias in this period under the guidance, with the direction and with the support of the Indonesian military was a deeply troubling experience for me. Yet this is history and it's not always pleasant. Let me now address something of the elephant in the room. Despite some of the challenges I've listed to you, perhaps the most difficult, frustrating and draining aspect of producing this volume had nothing to do with research or writing it. Rather, the bureaucratic process of clearing the book was the greatest challenge of all. In all, it took more than 3 years of negotiations, confrontations, and compromise to have the volume approved for publication in the form you see today. That was longer than it took to write. Of course, due to the nature of sources used in preparation, the draft volume was produced as a classified document for all of the appropriate reasons. It then entered a clearance process to ensure it contains no material inappropriate to release to the public domain. But this part of the process was relatively quick and frictionless and resulted in minimal changes, certainly none that came close to compromising the historical integrity of the volume. The area of ambiguity, though, was what might be understood as something of a blurred line between reasonable information security and institutional discomfort at various levels. This discomfort was very often about content, not classification. A very large part of those 3+ years of struggle were discussions, for example, of how much contextual and background material such a volume as this ought to contain. Now, my view is it needs to contain an amount of such material such that the average or public reader with no special background in East Timor should be able to make sense of the events of 1999. This included, for example, a longer-term survey of Australia's policy position with regards to the issue of East Timorese independence. This was never a view shared by all stakeholders. Indeed, it was vigorously contested by some. I remember one particular high-level meeting with very senior departmental representatives who congratulated me during this process on such a fine book, an excellent book, but then asked for the first 9 chapters to be removed on the grounds it should begin when the first Australian boot was on the ground in East Timor. A great way, perhaps, to avoid some uncomfortable policy truths, but no way to write history. From here, the back and forth began with agreements reached often only to have different sets of judges raise different objections. Even once the book was produced and about to be released, there remained echoes of arguments long past. The memorial itself did not have a book launch for this volume, a remarkable and unprecedented decision, though it did have an event a fortnight ago to mark the existence of the book, which was quite a nice event. Ladies and gentlemen, more broadly now that we're done, I'm sometimes asked what were the main themes or threads that emerged in the writing of this particular volume. Well, there are many, but let me share with you just two, one from a veteran's perspective and one from a policy perspective. If I were to point to one common refrain from most of the veterans we interviewed for this volume, and it was well more than 250 for this particular volume, it would be a certain duality of feelings about their experiences in East Timor. First of all, most are rightly proud of their efforts during this deployment. The idea of helping the Timorese remains a source of true professional satisfaction and personal pride. Witnessing the transition of Dili as a city in flames to one that was starting to rebuild in early 2000 sticks out in the minds of many, as do the smiling faces of East Timorese children and the grateful waves of their parents. At the same time, though, there is discomfort. It did not take long for the average serviceman or servicewoman, too busy with the task at hand to be concerned with high policy or strategic calculations, to understand the terrible acts of violence so recently committed and to understand who was responsible. Indeed, these Timorese often went out of their way to point out the perpetrators to ADF members. At the same time, these members were then often asked to work with, to conduct joint patrols, for example, the Indonesian counterparts, in the full knowledge the role of the latter had played. It was a type of friction then, it's a type of friction now that few have reconciled. Now, I've tended not throughout this process to have talked much about my own experiences in East Timor, and that's appropriate because as such a junior officer, my recollections were of very little use to the production of this volume. But I did speak recently with some personal flavour to an ABC interview, and I'll do so now, because I think it highlights some of the challenges pertinent when dealing with a human tragedy on the scale of East Timor. In this case, my infantry company was stationed in the small town of Mimo on the border with Indonesia, close to the regional hub of Maliana. On one particular day, part of the company was conducting a small medical clinic for some of the locals who'd been gradually returning to the decimated and actually still smouldering village. I was observing events as the company medic and some other soldiers were administering as best they could to the sick and injured. And suddenly a woman's desperate and pleading voice rang out, and a young mother with a baby in her arms came running towards us, just as some local men were trying unsuccessfully to restrain her sobbing advance. She was distraught with fear or with grief, I didn't initially know which. When she made it to where I was standing, she pushed forth her baby wrapped tight, which she'd been holding very close to her chest. I couldn't understand her panicked words, of course, but it seemed clear that she wanted help for her child. The baby, though, was dead. A large contusion on its forehead made it clear that it had been struck, we later found out, by militiamen. There was nothing that could be done. The feeling of powerlessness was remarkable, and this was part of the experience of many veterans in East Timor in 1999. At a policy level, let me say just this. One very interesting general observation will be the degree by which the public narrative about Australia's role in East Timor in 1999 has drifted from what might be called the historical truth of events. Much capital appears to be made by many in the two decades that followed based on the idea of the nobility and the morality of defending the rights of the East Timorese to have their own self-determination and defending them physically, of course, from the violence perpetuated against them by Indonesian-backed militias. The reality, though, was at once much more complex, yet distillable to a simple truth. Long-term Australian policy was to ensure that East Timor remained as part of the Unitary Republic of Indonesia. This was consistent and constant even after Indonesian President Habibie's unexpected announcement on a referendum as to the political fate of the new nation. That the final result was independence must therefore be understood as a significant policy failure for Australia. This is not to suggest that this long-term policy towards East Timor was without its real politic logic. In the words of other authors, the strategic value of the relationship with Jakarta was not going to be sacrificed for the sake of the East Timorese. A small and potentially mendicant state to the north was never seen to be in Australia's national interest, nor the potential fragmentation or balkanisation of Indonesia in the context of the Asian financial crisis. As this volume makes clear, Australian policy in East Timor in 1999 was far more complex than many existing accounts allow, but it was always guided by this realist and this realpolitik foreign policy logic. One, though, that was at odds in 1999 with how much of the Australian public saw the world and this nation's place within it. These two very different viewpoints did become aligned in September 1999. Policy did change at this point. When it was clear that there was no other option than a military intervention, then the full government and policy apparatus swung in behind that requirement, but not by choice, rather because of a series of events outside of Canberra-based bureaucratic control. As a historian, I observe, in such instances where there is such a divergence between public policy and the public will, there is invariably a reckoning. I'm no policymaker, I don't pretend to be, but significant variances like this are a dangerous phenomenon and they tend not to last. Well, the second question I'm occasionally asked is, what is the most surprising or specific discovery that was found during the process of research and writing the volume? To this question, I know one of the most startling individual findings for me was connected to Prime Minister Howard's famous letter to President Habibie of December 1998. Often portrayed as a significant government policy change, it was in fact nothing of the sort, despite claims to the contrary later on. Now, this letter from the Prime Minister suggests that Indonesia might consider granting East Timor a type of special status with a built-in review mechanism to be connected to self-determination in some future and unspecified date. So start a process, much like the case was in New Caledonia, that might result in some distant future with an act of self-determination. Mr. Howard never advocated independence in his letter. Why would he? That was not the nation's position. Now, the boon here was if such a non-specific process was begun, it might just take the heat out of the East Timor issue. It might remove the burr under the saddle, if you like, and smooth the relationship with Jakarta. For his part, President Habibie wanted none of it. He wanted to solve the East Timor problem, described by his policy aides as the albatross around Indonesia's neck. Seen by him and his advisers as a money sink, but not seen that way by the Indonesian armed forces. Habibie had already announced in June 1998 that he was ready to consider a special status for East Timor, so Mr Howard's suggestion wasn't new. After a great deal of hollow bluster about Australian imperialist meddling aimed at domestic Indonesian audience, a fateful cabinet meeting in Jakarta on the 27th of January of 1999 saw the president brandish the letter sent by Prime Minister Howard the previous month and suggesting that now, contrary to the advice given by the Australian Prime Minister, after a brief period of consultation, there would now be an act of determination to decide East Timor's political fate. The rest is history. Now, the remarkable facet about this process in my eyes was the fact that the letter itself was drafted by a small coterie of Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet officials and communicated by Mr. Downer to Mr. Howard as a great idea. At no point did anyone think to include the Department of Defence in this process. Indeed, to his considerable chagrin, the Acting Secretary of Defence found out about the letter's existence only after it had been sent. I think this is remarkable, given the role Defence was expected to play by the end of that year. Now, this is important. Amidst all of the difficulties I've listed and discussed, let me underscore one critical counterpoint, and that is the International Force East Timor, or INTERFET, was a resounding success. It's a story which all veterans and the wider community ought be proud. If the Defence Forces were perhaps underprepared, if the policy framework was contorted, if the strategic context complex, then it is an even greater testament to the skill and commitment and professionalism to those involved. For it's one thing, as I mentioned, to succeed when everything's running smoothly, it's another to do so under significant pressure and despite faults in the system. So as far as I'm concerned, double praise to all involved, not just those who deployed to East Timor, but the thousands back in Australia who worked to support that deployment. The contribution of these individuals is sometimes goes a little bit unsung, but it was nonetheless critical. Ladies and gentlemen, there is danger, no doubt, in placing an academic in front of a captured audience. I've talked too long. The role of an official historian, wrote Prime Minister Turnbull, who commissioned me in this job, is one of great national significance in ensuring the production of authoritative, comprehensive, and accurate accounts of Australia's military operations. This is quite the responsibility. I feel the weight, not only of tradition, but of expectation. I only hope, therefore, that this book is judged worthy of the efforts of all those involved in East Timor, of the crisis in 1999 and 2000, and worthy of those public expectations. My thanks to you all. Thanks, Gerard.
Well, many thanks to Professor Stockinson. I said at the start, copies of Born of Fire and Ash, Australia's Operations in Response to the East Timor Crisis, 1999-2000, is available here today. So now we're going to come to questions and discussion. So if you come back here, Craig, please, and we'll start off, and Anne will have the microphone over that side of the room. Thanks for a very important analysis, but just go back to when the decision was made. I mean, Prime Minister Howard wrote the letter. It was drafted from Foreign Affairs and PM&C, but the Prime Minister signed it. Defence wasn't involved, but eventually Defence got together a force which did very well, although, as you just point out in your book, it wasn't necessarily prepared for this particular military task. And it all worked out pretty well. Now, going back, don't most policy decisions in government in big events, most of them start off as a bit of a mess, don't they? I mean, there's never been a very clear idea about what people do if they go into war. I mean, this wasn't a war, this was a peacekeeping force, as you know, but isn't it all a bit messy? I mean, is there any particular facts that are particularly messy here, or is this just part of the fog of what people call the fog of war or the fog of peacekeeping? Let me just come back to here.
To respond to that question, I think the most remarkable thing about Australian policy towards the East Timor question was its consistency and its clarity. There were no dissenting voices in Canberra about the correct policy that ought to be applied to this problem, and I've described what that policy was. There is never lactis logic, but 20,000 people marched in Sydney here, 40,000 in Melbourne, demanding a military intervention, if you can remember back then, in the post-Vietnam environment. Remarkable. This is what I mean when I talk about our divergence between public policy and the public will and how that came crashing back together. Look, as far as defences preparedness goes, I make the observation after what were a couple of decades worth of cost cutting in the name of efficiency, is that efficiency doesn't always mean cost cutting in the reverse. The defence forces weren't prepared to deploy and support the scale of force that was required in East Timor, and this was a permissive environment. The decisions made were made not to contest that lodgement were made before the force ever went. In fact, I go one step further. There are a couple of boxes that need to be checked before INTERFET was ever real. One of which, for example, was an unlimited American offer of insurance that existed. Another one was the East Timorese agreed. That was the case. So these decisions whether what was going to happen on the ground unfolded before soldiers arrived on the ground. Hence my point about the importance of talking about the political context. That doesn't mean that an incident couldn't have happened during INTERFET, that someone could have got shot at any moment. In fact, if we'd have followed our own rules of engagement, there would have been a heck of a lot more shooting incidents. But there was never going to be a fight with the corporate entity of ABRI or TNI, because that was already decided.
Just for those who are young enough not to remember, TNI...
I can't. I'm not going to pretend to pronounce the acronym.
The
Indonesian Armed Forces.
Okay. All right. Just stay here. Where you don't move. Just stay.
Okay. We'll do.
Okay. Anne.
Just following on from that, and having lived through all of this, it was an extraordinary moment for an Australian of my generation. We'd had such a long period when our defence forces hadn't really been engaged in much at all. And then they're suddenly off to this campaign in East Timor. And looking at it, it was terribly successful. It was amazingly successful. And I just wonder if you could give us some idea of what it was about the Australian leadership and the fact that it was a peacekeeping force and the fact that Australia was involved that made it so special. Because it did achieve the end in very difficult circumstances. And maybe it was because... they had cutbacks. I don't know.
Look, there's a tradition within the ADF to make things work despite the circumstances. That was very much present. And we fell over the line in East Timor without any opposition. There were two people qualified to operate a petrol pump in Dili at the time. That's a significant point of failure had one of them got sick. There was no ammunition. It took 6 weeks to get water. We were living off water from the Coca-Cola factory in Darwin. Defence was hollowed out. Leadership-wise, and I would never take anything away from the job done by General Cosgrove and the senior bureaucrats and politicians at the time. They made it work. And it was remarkable in the way that it did work, despite the obstacles in its place. But I do make the point that in retrospect, not that we knew that at the time, some people knew it at the time, but as a historian, in retrospect, the outcome was in many ways predetermined, because the decisions not to challenge in effect had already been made. There was always risk, as I've mentioned. I'm often people raise the fact that it was just the professional demeanour and the technology of the Australian soldiers on the ground, the labs which provided such a deterrent effect. Yeah, maybe, but the decision had already been made.
By the decision had already been made, just what decision are you talking about?
I'm talking about the decision in Jakarta not to contest the landing of INTERFET. If that decision hadn't been made or communicated, there would not have been an INTERFET.
Yeah. One military man put it to me at the time that we went there, taking your point about the petrol pump, not equipped to project force overseas because there was nowhere to get petrol, there was nowhere to get supplies. It was a very, very, very underdeveloped part of the world. And it was sort of touch and go for those particular reasons, apart from a resistance. And then another senior military person at the same time, just after it was all over, said, well, you go on military activities with what you got. But you're saying that because of the rundown over that period through the 70s through into the 80s and into the 80s into the 90s, we weren't prepared.
I'll be more specific. The white paper asked Defence to be able to provide a brigade-level group of forces, which is a significant amount, 5,000 troops, overseas for an ill-defined amount of time. The ADF was not able to do that. It barely was able to sustain East Timor. You don't get any closer to the Australian mainland than East Timor. People were riding back home and getting their rear echelons and others to post parts forward using Australia Post to make it work. This is not a criticism of those involved. That's just the reality of how things were. Back to Anne's question, I think it's interesting to reflect on how much that success and all of the political capital and social capital that came out of that, how much influence might that have had on decisions to go next time is an interesting question, the time after. Had it not proceeded so well, perhaps those calculations might have been different. Because the national security apparatus, let's be frank, in Canberra was unpracticed at this. Even committee structures are built on the run. There was no institutional memory of how to do this. So as I said at the end there, to me, double praise to all involved that it still worked despite those realities.
Question.
Do you want me to stand up?
No.
Owen Ether, Craig. Part of your answer has come to my question, which is one of capability and capacity. Not being in the forces, but of them at the time, I observed over that period that we're talking about, particularly the late 80s and into the 90s, the army being the balancing item for the defence budget to pay for, help pay for F-111s and Collins-class submarines. And not core assets or capabilities were stripped and stripped and stripped from the army, particularly in logistics. And we've just talked about that. My view is that if the situation you've spoken about came 6 months later than it had, the Australian Defence Force would not have been able to mount the operation that it did. And that's one answer that I'd be interested in hearing your answer for. It may well be happening again. You may not wish to answer this, but we've now got enormous amounts of money for SSNs and F-35 fleets. Is the army going to be once more the sacrificial lamb?
I suspect in some regards, Owen, those discussions are already going on. There's only so much pie to be distributed, right? So that, I don't know anything more than that. Now, I do make the observation to answer your question. I speak often to audiences of defence members, colonels and these and sorts, and I outline these sorts of difficulties. And sometimes the response is, yes, that's very well, Craig, but that's ancient history. It doesn't happen now. It's all better. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But I make this observation. Sometimes I feel that the ADF extant, that is now, feels quite confident because it's been at war for 20 years in its mind in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. We study those theatres and the volumes will follow. It hasn't been at war. Small amounts of 200, 250 person groups have been in a high intensity war. But the organisation has been fitted into someone else's strategic construct, someone else's administrative construct, its logistic chains. This is not deploying a force. This is taking a very small packet and giving it to somebody else to conduct operations. That's not to in any way cast aspersions on the roles played by the individual or the intensity of the experience they experience, because it's high. But that is well practiced at a certain type of activity, at a certain type of tactical level. What hasn't been tested is logistics, theatre level command, Australian operational control of large scale forces or area, the sorts of things that get mooted about now, the holiday from history is over and we're concerned about the Asia Pacific and peer challenges. There's been no experience like that since East Timor, and that was uncontested. It's been a long time. So confidence may be well placed. What do I know? I'm a pointy head. Maybe not.
Just on the decision, you mentioned the decision of President Habibie, and you looked at Australian material, you haven't looked at Indonesian material. Why do you think the President came to that decision that there would be no resistance to the arrival of Interfet?
Oh, that's not a hard one to answer, Jared. No, we didn't have Indonesian documents, so we did interview senior Indonesian policymakers at the time to give some sense of what was happening in the Indonesian cabinet room. I think if you may recall that President Clinton, before he left for APAC in August 1999, just before he got onto that really old Air Force One helicopter, made a comment that went something like, if Indonesia continues down this path, it faces a point of no return in international relations. That is about as strong a declaration of intent as is ever going to be found in open diplomacy. It was stop this nonsense or else. In the context of the Asian financial crisis, as I've mentioned, there was significant pressure put on by places like the IMF. I think Clinton's other, or one of his aides' other comments that August was Indonesia threatens its recovery by continuing to act in this manner. That gets the attention of policymakers in Jakarta in a way that Canberra doesn't. Yeah. Yeah, we might be the centre of their world, it's not necessarily the same. I make the point also that Admiral Dennis Blair, who was at the time Commander-in-Chief of Pacific Command, or PACOM, a force larger than the ADF and certainly postured for conflict, made a number of visits to General Wiranto on the eve of this deployment, making American position eminently clear.
My question has been answered by your question about the United States.
It's interesting. There were some comments made by politicians in the press about America wasn't there in our time of need. Nothing could be further from the truth. Yeah. The Americans had their own distaste for peacekeeping at that time. Congress was hostile, but American assurances were in place, and American troops were on the ground too, for that matter, just not many and no shooters. But they were floating around in a Marine Amphibious Task Force, which sends signals all of its own. But beyond that military stuff, the diplomatic and economic pressure had already yielded results.
You answered that. It's been answered. Yeah.
Thank you, Craig, for fascinating discourse. I actually want to ask a question from a quite different perspective, which actually was historical evidence. You talked about historians only ever work from a fraction of the evidence, and that's very true, and then look to try and match a whole series of pieces of evidence to then try and draw conclusions. What you, of course, painted for us was an absolute mass of electronic evidence, and that historians are now moving into a quite different area where they've really got to sift them. And very early in your talk, you talked about PhDs being able to race into this area for some time to come. Given that mass of evidence, are you able to comment more on why you're obviously confident that you've managed to be able to sort of draw the links together? But obviously you haven't been able to cover all of the evidence that was discoverable. So
I'm going to mention the word robots in my answer. I never thought about that tonight. But why am I confident? Because I had $17.6 million and 22 full-time staff to do this. No private individual academic researcher is going to have the same resources. I have in my compactus 500,000 hand-picked classified documents to answer the specific questions that we have to answer. And I remember, these aren't general histories, they're on Australian operations, so they're quite focused. We have 2,500 interviews conducted with veterans to that end. So I'm reasonably confident, not wholly confident, because that's never the case, reasonably confident through the triangulation of evidence, as you say, both oral and written and various sources, that we've got it about technically right. But we'll be wrong around the edges, hopefully not in the middle, and that will be grist for future historians. Now, the second question, am I confident that PhDs or whatnot are going to be able to do this work and challenge the conclusions? A different question. But there's light here. The fact that all of the data exists is something, because it doesn't exist for World War II, for example, or anything else. The trick then is, how does an individual access the data in a meaningful way to write from, to find things we haven't found? The answer to that, having done, in my view, having done a little bit of work with some of the artificial intelligence folk at Kensington here, there needs to be an agent between the human researcher and the infinite data. That agent, to my mind, needs to take an artificially intelligent form. It needs to understand the questions I'm asking it and refine the answers to it. That technology is pretty available, sort of Google on steroids, right, where it gives you your own, it reacts to your choices. That's possible, but it means reframing what an archive is. in the future, an archive is just a warehouse of stuff. And there's a robot somewhere that helps me find the stuff I need and shows me the links, searching metadata and all these sorts of stuff, so I can answer the questions I'm after, which is really a different way of thinking than how things are structured now. I see no other alternative, because this data is not curated. It just exists. But I think there's hope too.
I've got a question here from one of our Zoom watchers. The reference to the letter drafted by Department of Foreign Affairs without consulting the Department of Defence. The question is, was the intention to cut defence out of the process, or did it just happen?
Look, intentions are very hard things to measure as a historian, but I can give you some of my beliefs there rather than empirical-based stuff. I don't think that's a deliberate thing in any case. Remember, defence back in the 90s is just stay quiet in the back of the room. You're not relevant here. That's not true now, but that's the policy dynamic in Canberra in the 90s. You bring defence in, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. In fact, if you bring defence in, then the diplomatic efforts have already failed, haven't they? So there's dynamics at play here, and yes, there are personalities at play, of course. I don't think it's deliberate. I just don't think there was, despite the whole of government rhetoric, there was seen as a need. Because, of course, the policy was going to work, right?
I do have a question. Right. The Second World War started off with Sir Frederick Seddon had a war book, which he, I don't know how useful it was in the long run, but I don't know if we have anything equivalent today. That's question one. Question two is electronic records. No one knows how long they last. You know, we all know that in the early 19th century, with the technology of paper, that many printing things just faded away. So what do we do about preserving records so that they don't cease to exist after a time?
So first, second part of the question first, if I might.
Yeah.
The great advantage of the electronic files is they don't decay like paper does when it gets wet and these sorts of things.
Yeah.
The question then is about that technology changes all the time. So when I spoke about hard drives no longer readable because the format's different, they're eminently solvable technical questions as long as there's the will to solve them. And backups and all the rest of it. Space is cheap.
Right.
I mean, it's doable as long as there's a will for it to be done. First part of your question, I'm in no privileged position to speak about, not that I could anyway, classified defence war planning. There is a whole organisation called Headquarters Joint Operations Command. I'd be aghast if it didn't have the modern day version of what to do in the event of war in a number of circumstances. That's what we do in peacetime, right? I don't know that to be true.
Have I missed anyone? So
can I just ask something about, I'm interested in you having such confidence about electronic records, because I've been on the New South, I was the chair of the New South Wales Archives, and I'm on the council down in Canberra. One of the major problems for archives is getting government to fund them to electrify their records. I think we've got about 16%, maybe less, of the National Archives, and it may take to the end of never to get most of it done. It just never happened. Can you comment on how you bring to bear the importance of this to government? Because I tell you what, everywhere I've been for the last 10 years, we've been racking our brains.
It's a money problem. And big data is not new to industry. It's not a new phenomenon where companies make money from it, et cetera, et cetera. What you're talking about here is, and I tried to allude to that earlier, is the intent to preserve or the value to preserve. Why am I confident? I'm not sure I'm that confident, but there is an Archives Act that has to be adhered to. I think also where it will become a point of interest to the departments themselves is if there's ever legal cases that are going to involve the requirement to find records and they can't be found. I think that will focus the mind. I'm not confident right now. I'm confident that it exists and there is a way forward if the investment was made in that way forward.
Just a final question. As you know, Peter Crossgrove has praised your book, but there'll be critics as well. There are critics as well. So we know what Peter Crossgrove said has been reported. What's the kind of criticism that you're getting?
Feedback thus far has reasonably positive. The interesting thing for most veterans, for example, is as a deploying sailor, airman, soldier, you know what about this much in front of you, and that's 24 hours of your time. So a company commander is not aware of policy dynamics in Canberra. Policymakers in Canberra aren't aware of the experience of a platoon commander on the ground. One of the power, I think, of these sorts of works is to bring that together. So one of the feedbacks I get often is, oh, that makes sense now. What appeared insane at the time on the ground actually has a reason that it was that way. That's one bit of feedback. There is negative feedback too. It's been, 20-something years? It's human nature to reflect on your experiences in a certain way and to understand your part in those experiences in certain ways, and that the internalisation of your own memory can diverge from one person to the next. There are some people who are adamant that what we've written is wrong. Now, I'm really open to correcting what's wrong. I just require a bit more evidence than I don't remember it that way. That's not to disrespect those memories. Everyone is subject to these challenges. But some of the negative feedback is it's just not how I remember it. That's fair. It's not often how I remember it either. But it's my job to triangulate evidence and trace and explain based on evidence, not on sentiment, which doesn't make it easier.
Craig Sookie, many thanks. Well, many thanks for that. As I said, we've got copies of Born of Fire and Ash on sale tonight, and it'll be online later. And you, as you concluded your comments, you made a point about a book based on evidence, and that clearly with this quite massive book, and there's only volume one, it's all based on evidence. And tonight you've given us your evidence and a lot of explanation about how you wrote the book. It is important that we have this book out and the next volume, because as Anne was saying and you said, it was a very successful operation, and all Australians should be aware of that. So for your contribution to that tonight, well done, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.